immigrant, and pro-gun today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. As a teenager, Luis Quiñones left war-torn Guatemala for the U.S. He now owns several guns and is a member of the NRA.
Among the immigrants from various countries, I'm not unique. 60% of the people share the same views, especially those who have lived through the unrests in their native countries.
Also, the Dutch helped New Orleans think differently about water after Katrina. Now they're helping Norfolk, Virginia do it too.
Just as in New Orleans, we showed them they didn't need to fight the water, they needed to find ways to bring it in.
Plus, why some bumblebees in London have numbers on their backs.
The specific purpose of the tagging the bees is to encourage people to view bees as individuals.
That's all coming up today on The World. Today, a lot of Americans are wondering why Washington can't pass gun control legislation. The U.S. Senate rejected a number of such measures yesterday, even after last week's mass shooting in Orlando. It feels as if Americans on both sides of the gun debate are unwilling to even talk to each other. So we start the show today with an opinion that might surprise you. It's from a National Rifle Association member who supports several gun control measures.
I think that just the fact that you got the money and you can go, you have a clear background, you know, clean sheet, you go and buy one without ever having taken the first step to learn why and how, it's very dangerous.
Luis Quiñones is a member of the NRA. When he was 17 years old, he moved to the U.S. from Guatemala. Quiñones says growing up in a country at war made him appreciate gun ownership.
In one particular case, I remember we almost got shot with a family. Several bullets hit just about a foot in the top of us, which is not something you want to remember the rest of your life, to be sure.
Yeah.
So the violence, some people think that if you see enough of it, you get insulated. No, it's not. I don't care how many times you see it, every time it impacts you.
Can you imagine, though, if those guns had not been available to anybody in Guatemala? Wouldn't your life be completely different?
Well, but it goes to show you that the people who want guns will get them. Guns in Mexico, guns in Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras, which has some of the highest murder rates in the world, are illegal. You know, in order to get one, you have to go through so many rules. And in essence, you have to know someone, the vice president, the presidency of the country, to get a permit. Yet, everyone is aware of the tremendous massacres that happen every day in Mexico, every day in Guatemala. El Salvador is one of the worst, most violent countries in the world.
You do accept the fact that some of those guns, a lot of those guns, are coming from the United States, where there are a lot of loose guns.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, we know some of them, our government was responsible for it. We understand that there is a lot of illegal trade.
What do you own today in terms of firearms?
I own an AR-15, a shotgun, and I also own six handguns of different calibers, and they all have a purpose. You know, some people say, well, why do you own six guns, you know, handguns? And because one is a 22, which I use for target practice, frankly, because it's cheaper to shoot the 22, 20% of the cost of a 45, for example, bullet. Mm. So I use it. And I also use the 22 to teach some of the people who had never shot before. I used it to train my own children, you know, when they were 8, 9 years old, to show them respect, not fear. And we never had a problem where they were curious and they wanted to touch the gun or grab it or whatever. You know, they learn from an early age that is not a toy. That's what's lacking in our community. Yes, would I like to be in utopia? Of course.
What do you tell people when they say, wow, AR-15, why do you need an assault rifle?
In my case, it's because it reminds me of my youth when I was serving in the United States Marine Corps and the hot jungles of Vietnam. And, you know, the first rifle that basically protected my life was the AR-15. Well, and let me tell you, I think part of me bought it because of this constant attack on the Second Amendment. You know, some of the other side is saying, you know, these are bad, 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 bad. So curiosity says, let me find out why. So I tried it. Nostalgia, you know, when I was a young kid, stupid kid, defending, you know, whatever ideals we were defending back in Vietnam. And most people that I, when I speak to people about why do they own the AR-15s or AK-47s, it's because they're saying, well, you know, we heard so much about it that they attacked it, attack it, attack it, attack it, that I want to see what is it all about.
Luis, are people surprised when they find out you're an immigrant and a member of the NRA?
Yes, but I actually find that surprise more from the non-immigrant side, the white side, let's say. Number one, they hear me, they say, so you're a U.S. citizen, right? I said, absolutely. And, I was a military officer, and they're kind of surprised. And then when they hear me speak about my views on gun control, immigration issues, they kind of are taken back. However, among my contemporaries, the immigrants from various countries, I'm not unique. I think that we share, 60% of the people share the same views, especially those who have lived through the unrests in their native countries.
Luis Quiñones, 64-year-old businessman, was born in Guatemala. He's now a U.S. citizen and a member of the NRA. Luis, great to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Here's another perspective on guns and the effects they can have on people's lives. In certain parts of the Middle East, gunfire isn't always what it seems. From Beirut, here's the world's Richard Hall.
This is what a funeral sounds like in Lebanon. Also, birthdays, graduations, New Year's Eve. Firing your AK-47 into the air is the preferred method of celebrating for many Lebanese. But what goes up must come down. That's something Bayan Bibi learned the hard way 3 years ago on a busy street in West Beirut.
I was walking here on the street with my friend Rania, and suddenly I felt something came to my back, as if there is a stone came from above. So I told my friend, I told her, Rania, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. I don't know what happened to me.
Bayan didn't know it at the time, but she was hit by a bullet fired from another neighborhood. Lebanon's parliament speaker and leader of the Amal movement, Nabi Berri, had appeared on television moments before. His followers had fired their weapons into the air to show support. Bayan was rushed to hospital with a bullet in her chest.
The bullet entered my right lung, and then it sit on the third and the fourth of the ribs. And he was thinking that this is the end of my life, And everything happening around me, I don't care because I am going,
Bayan pulled through without serious lasting damage. But last month, a firefighter was killed by celebratory gunfire. And three others died in the spring, including an 8-year-old girl. Lawmakers have just proposed tougher penalties for anyone caught firing a weapon in a crowded area. The leader of Hezbollah, whose supporters are among the worst offenders, has called on his followers to stop many times, to no avail. I wanted to find out what motivates someone to fire into the air like this, so I went to Dahir, a poor neighborhood in South Beirut. I met Mohammed, a 23-year-old supporter of Nabi Berri, the parliament speaker. By his own admission, he's a repeat offender.
Yeah, mostly when a leader comes out and gives a speech, that's the main, and also sometimes in maybe weddings, someone passes his exams. Every occasion, celebration, we try to make the most of it and fire our weapons.
So it's kind of, when your politician speaks, it's kind of to show support for whoever's speaking on TV. Is that right?
Yeah, it's like supporting our leaders. Yeah, exactly. To support them and show, we have your back when you need us. It's like measuring the
What do you think about that, though? When you fire the gun in the air, you obviously know it's going to come down somewhere. Do you ever think that it might hurt someone? Or what's going through your head when you're doing that?
When you're doing that, it's an adrenaline rush. You don't think of anything. I'm not going to lie. The feeling is good, but maybe after you finish, you think, oh, maybe I might have hurt someone. Maybe it fell on someone's car, broke the glass, You think of the consequences, but after you finish.
I asked Mohammed whether the legislation that's been proposed would stop anyone from firing their guns.
I don't think so, because, the law doesn't have that much of a presence or effect in our area.
In Lebanon, it's political parties rather than the government that provides basic services to the population. As a result, the government doesn't have much of a presence in Dahir.
Not because we don't want them to come. We would love their help. But they abandoned us many, many years ago. So we're self-sufficient. We have our own law.
As for Bayan, the woman wounded by a falling bullet, she says she's not angry at the person who fired the gun, whoever that may be.
I don't blame him. I blame the people who are responsible, the minister or the political people who raised their supporters and fans in this negative way.
And while she's doubtful the legislation would make much of a difference, she wants people to think twice about celebrating with gunfire.
I am not blaming anybody, but I am just making awareness, just to stop this violence. To stop expressing always in our feelings in a violent way. That's it.
For the World, Richard Hall, Beirut.
Celebrating is something Mexican soccer fans are not doing too much these days. Their national team lost to Chile in the quarterfinal of the Copa America soccer tournament. And not just lost, Chile obliterated Mexico, 7-0. Yeah, not much to cheer about. To add to that, there are now calls for Mexican soccer fans to change the way they cheer. Leon Krause is a Mexican journalist and news anchor with Univision. He wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post explaining why it's time for a certain homophobic chant to stop.
The word they use, I'm going to use it, Marco, is puto. Puto is a word like many words in Spanish that can be used in many different ways, has many different meanings, but one of them is a homophobic slur. And I argue that while some people might say that Mexican fans don't really have that intention, what matters here is not the cause or the motive behind the chant, but the effect it has caused with the LGBT community for a while now, and it's time for it to stop.
Give us the context in which this one cheer is used. It's typically against a opposing goalkeeper, correct?
That is correct. When the opposing goalkeeper takes a goal kick or clears the ball from his box, the Mexican crowd just goes wild and yells this word. Maybe FIFA has to intervene and sanction Mexico, maybe ban the presence of fans from the venues in the upcoming World Cup qualifiers, or maybe even go further, because it really has no place on a soccer venue. Just like racist chants, of course, in Europe, for example, should be banned one way or the other.
Well, the controversy over this one phrase, this one chant, has been on FIFA's radar screen for a while. Why is it resurfacing now?
The Copa America is a very important tournament. It's the continental tournament. For the first time, I would say, teams from the whole continent have been playing in it. Panama, Jamaica, the United States, Mexico, and of course the great South American powerhouses. It's been held in the United States, seen all over the world, and it's been, it's been very clear that the chant's been there. Univision, the company I work for, has been putting out a statement, reading a statement before every match, saying that it basically distancing itself from the chant. It's become quite a scandalous. And while some people might think it's fun to just join in the crowd and yell this word that, again, in Mexico has many different meanings, it's not fun. And we should just stick to the words of a very famous Mexican president, Benito Juárez, the only Mesoamerican Indian president we've ever had back in the 19th century, who used to say, "El respeto al derecho ajeno es la paz." Respect to others. In respect to others, you find peace. Mm. And that's what we should basically think about.
Is this all on the shoulders of Mexican soccer fans? Do you find this chant in other countries as well?
I think that some other national teams have maybe taken to doing the same thing. But basically, it's Mexico. Basically, it's the Mexican fans. And as a lifelong soccer fan, when I think of the Mexican wave and how beautiful it was, I remember it from my childhood, or some other beautiful chants that we have that are not aggressive, that are incredibly touching. It makes me really angry, because we should not be, when you think of Mexican soccer in general, or remember for this horrible thing.
What is special about the Mexican wave?
Oof. Well, I was 11 years old in 1986 for the World Cup, and it just looked like a hurricane slowly rotating. I mean, I remember how the stadium buzzed, the feet of 120,000 fans pounding against concrete, and just the feeling of glee, of joy when we stood up and just tried to mimic the sound of a wave coming ashore. It was beautiful. And that's how Mexican soccer fans and Mexican soccer should be thought of in the world, not this horrible thing.
Bring back the Mexican wave.
Absolutely.
Leon Krause, Univision news anchor. Great to have you on the show. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, Marco.
Coming up, bumblebees with tiny license plates. Seriously, this is the world. Norfolk, Virginia has two things working against it. One is that the city is located right on Chesapeake Bay and sea levels are rising. On top of that, Norfolk is slowly sinking. That's why the city's called in some global experts when it comes to living with water, the Dutch. From the World's Environment Desk, Carolyn Beeler has a second part of our series on rising seas.
Cheryl Sumner grew up along the water in Norfolk. About 15 years ago, she moved back to her childhood home to raise her kids.
It was wonderful that my kids were able to have the same upbringing that I had.
Sumner's stately brick house in the Chesterfield Heights neighborhood is across the street from the Elizabeth River, which is one of many inlets from the nearby Chesapeake Bay. And there's a narrow riverfront park that was perfect for kids.
They did not spend time in the house on their PlayStations. They were outside playing football. They used to go out and try to catch some crabs and whatever.
But
the downside is that when we have a heavy rain event, we flood.
Water surges in from the river and backs up storm sewers so the streets can't drain. There are only two roads out of the neighborhood, and sometimes one of them is impassable.
See where that car is right now? Flood's there. And it gets problematic because we're just at the mercy of the flooding. Sometimes you can't get in, you can't get out.
Lots of Norfolk floods like this, says Deputy City Manager Ron Williams.
Well, we're in the tidewater region of coastal Virginia. We sit in a very flat area, not very high above sea level.
Much of the city was built on swamps and streams. The land has been slowly sinking for thousands of years. And now water is also rising as climate change affects sea levels. Between the two factors, relative sea level here could rise as much as 6 feet by the end of the century. And on top of that, Williams says the storms that cause flooding are happening more often.
We saw in the 2000s more major coastal storms, such as a nor'easter and hurricanes, in that one decade than we had seen in the previous four decades.
Williams says the situation is only going to get worse. So Norfolk has turned to the world's experts for help. The Dutch have fought the seas for centuries, and their expertise is now in high demand. Here in the U.S., they've worked with New Orleans after Katrina and New York after Sandy. They came to Norfolk last summer, and they brought their new approach.
Just as in New Orleans, we showed them they didn't need to fight the water. They needed to find ways to bring it in.
That's Dale Morris at the Dutch Embassy in Washington. He says this new living with water approach is also a big change for the Dutch themselves. Until about 30 years ago, they thought about water the way a lot of U.S. cities still do.
You build big infrastructure to stop the water.
But Morris says climate change is bringing a new reality.
What happens with sea level rise or with more extreme precipitation is you can't build your infrastructure high enough or strong enough in a cost-efficient way. So you need to do something else. And one of the ways you do that is by bringing the water in, embracing the water as opposed to fighting it.
A week-long Dutch dialogue workshop brought local and Dutch experts together last summer in Norfolk to design new ways to deal with water. The city walked away with general inspiration, but also blueprints for specific neighborhoods. One was for Cheryl Sumner's Chesterfield Heights neighborhood.
This was the part that excited the Dutch the most, I think.
Architecture professor Mason Andrews points to what will be a new hybrid flood control project. A main road will be raised up on a new dike. It'll block storm surges from the bay and allow rainwater to spread out into a marsh to prevent flooding. At other times, though, tide gates will allow for the normal ebb and flow of water. Andrews and her students at Hampton University developed plans that were incorporated into Norfolk's Dutch dialogues.
In our work in school, we've come to think of every project as having two components. One is barriers to stormwater, and the other is sponges, all of those many kinds of things we can think of to do that will store water until the weather event has moved on.
The sponges in this neighborhood plan include marshes, rain gardens, and pavement that allows water to soak into the ground instead of running off. The barriers include a berm along the shore in front of Cheryl Sumner's house, where it already floods sometimes. That, too, though, has a Dutch twist. It'll have a walking path and marsh plants that will be able to migrate up the shore as water levels rise. Sumner says she's happy that this new nature-based approach doesn't include a big concrete wall along the river.
If you build a wall right there in itself, you then kind of cut off your intimate relationship with the water. You're not going to be to get as close to the water. I like the way we're headed now.
The federal government has also endorsed this approach. Earlier this year, Virginia won a big federal grant, and almost all of it will be spent on adaptation in Chesterfield Heights and surrounding neighborhoods. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Norfolk, Virginia.
Tomorrow we'll hear the downside of this living with water approach from Dutch residents who gave up their homes to make way for a river. You can check out our entire series on sea level rise online at pri.org/risingseas. And we've got an interactive map there you'll want to check out. Just type in your address and see how rising sea levels might affect you and your home in the coming years. Okay, from seas to bees now. Not just any bees, though. I'm talking bumblebees with numbered license plates glued to their backs. This is real, and it happened today. 500 such bees were released in London, part of something called the London Pollinator Project. Clint Perry of Queen Mary University is coordinating the effort.
The specific purpose of the tagging the bees is actually to encourage people to view bees as individuals, not just as little machines or pests or unthinking animals, but actually individuals with memories and preferences for their specific gardens. And hopefully with these little license plates, so-called, on their backs, then people might be able to see, say, Blue 52 in their garden and actually form maybe a little emotional attachment to them when they come back and miss them when they're gone.
It sounds like you're getting the public engaged on this for some very specific reasons. Is it about the importance and the increasing realization why bees are important to people?
Yeah, exactly. The bee population in, well, throughout the world is in decline. And in the UK, bumblebee species are in decline. And we're hoping to create more of an awareness for this, to their importance ecologically. They're important for biodiversity, which is important for the ecosystem. But also economically, we rely on bees for a lot of our food.
Should I be surprised that this is happening in a city and not in a kind of a rural environment?
No. Well, I guess that's the point of the project itself, is that, see, the reason bees are in decline is because of urban development and intensive agricultural practices. So in the city, we are thinking that the people within the city can kind of balance out this loss of resources, all of these loss of wildflowers, by planting in their own green spaces.
Clint Perry, who's coordinating the London Pollinator Project, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. On Thursday, Britain will decide whether it wants to stay in the European Union or leave. But British expats, like this man in France, can't vote.
This affects us directly and personally, every one of us. And nobody has given us a word in it.
That story coming up right here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The nation with the largest oil reserves in the world is starving. In Venezuela, soldiers stand guard over bakeries and butcher shops because, along with food trucks, grocery stores, and supermarkets, they're all under constant attack. Everyone is looking for food. Hannah Dreyer is a correspondent for the Associated Press based in the capital, Caracas. Dreyer says the food shortage is having far-reaching effects.
People here are warning that we might see a lost generation. Basically, what's happened is kids have missed an entire year of school. The estimate is that a third of teachers every day are just not going to work. Instead, they're going out to wait in food lines. And I talked to a director at one school who told me that she wasn't even bothering trying to shame teachers into coming back from the food lines. Instead, she was going to the supermarkets and asking if these teachers could cut in line so that maybe they could get their sugar or their flour a little faster and come back and still have a little bit of the day to teach the kids.
That's pretty sad. Some students are still showing up to class, though. Why would you go to school when you know classes are probably going to be canceled?
Yeah, it's really amazing to me that these kids are still making what's often a dangerous journey to these schools. They see robberies, they see lootings on their way to school. They often have to go with no breakfast and no lunch because they don't have food at home. But they know that school is their best chance of escaping life here. And life here is becoming really hard. They want to get out just like most people in Venezuela do. So they go to school, they do their homework, and then they just kind of wait around all day. It's like one long lunch hour. Kids waiting in the hallways, gambling. Kids are getting into trouble while they wait for their teachers. Mm. But they're trying hard to learn something and get out.
The prediction of a lost generation suggests, though, that this is not an abnormality. It's going to continue for a while to come. What are people there in Caracas telling you about their thoughts about the future?
Yeah, it's really sad because education here for a long time was pretty great. Venezuela has a literacy rate of 95%, which is high in the region. And the socialist revolution made education one of its top priorities. But right now, even the people who are in charge of education say that their priority is food, is trying to get food for the cafeteria if they can. Often they can't. Often those cafeterias are raided by robbers or sometimes by the administrators themselves. And so for next year, nobody's really looking to get kids back into school, to get teachers back into school. They're, like most people, just focused on keeping people fed.
What have you been hearing about actual starvation, like people showing up to the hospital fainting?
What I'm seeing is people who've lost a lot of weight in recent months. And I'm also seeing people who say that they're choosing between feeding themselves and feeding their children. Or there might be a sick person in the family who's going to get dinner that night and nobody else will. People aren't yet in a situation where they're going to the hospital because they don't have enough food. But that's definitely the fear that's in the back of everyone's mind and probably what's fueling a lot of this food violence.
I mean, the food supplies are so bad. I've read that airlines have canceled flights and Coke has stopped production in Venezuela because of a lack of sugar. How are you managing, Hannah? What are you eating?
Yeah, you know, for the first time in years, I can't find enough food. And that's really saying something because usually the problem is that food is too expensive for people to buy, but there's enough of it. Right now, even me with my access to dollars, even going to the black market, I can't find a lot of the things that I want.
So you've got the money. There just isn't anything to buy, really.
Yeah, this weekend I wanted to make a cake and I went out looking for flour, eggs, sugar, and milk. And I looked hard and I was pretty much willing to pay whatever price somebody wanted to sell them at. And I couldn't find a single one of those things. I made an apple crisp instead.
Hannah Dreyer in Caracas with the Associated Press. Thank you very much as always, Hannah.
Thank you.
One way or another, Thursday will be a fateful day in Britain and for the EU. Voters in the UK will head to the polls to decide whether the country should leave the European Union or stay in it. Brits who live in France, Spain, and elsewhere in the EU are more than a little on edge, partly because they can't vote in the UK referendum. Reporter Adeline Seal introduces us to a British couple who have lived in France for the past 16 years.
Melanie and Paul Ryan live in the middle of the French countryside in the small village of Aigrizelle among green fields in Burgundy. They run a small language center and teach English classes in their renovated farmhouse.
The original buildings are 18th century pre-revolution farm buildings.
This house was occupied by the Germans during the war.
Melanie is passionate about history, and her husband Paul loves guitars, judging from the dozen lining up against the living room wall.
Why are there so many guitars here, Paul?
Because I like playing them.
He suffered from guitar acquisition syndrome.
Yes.
Paul is from Liverpool, and Melanie is a Londoner who, as Paul says, seems to know everything.
Well, I've got to say, the kids always ask you when they want to know something. We call Melanie the Melopedia. It's quicker than going to the computer and looking it up on Wikipedia, except if they want to know anything about... No, actually, it's always you, isn't it?
Now, because of the legendary rivalry between the French and the Brits, I have to ask how well this British family has settled in the little French village. That immediately brings up classic, contentious French-English history.
Ever since, when was it, Waterloo? The Hundred Years' War, who won? I still don't remember.
No, the French won the Hundred Years' War, but it took them 100 years.
Yeah, so... I mean, we've been the best of friends and the best of enemies for forever. And we kind of enjoy it. We can have a gentle prod at the, you know, the snail eating, frog's leg eating frogs.
You know, they do call us roast beef. Yeah. Les frogies and roast beef.
So let's just say that les roast beef seem to have made a pretty good go of living among the froggies. As European citizens, they enjoy the same rights and freedoms French people do.
We can register our cars, we can buy property, we can even, if necessary, claim social security if we need to. We get the same child allowances and child benefits.
But that access to social benefits could change if Britain goes for Brexit. Melanie and Paul are just two of an estimated 1.2 million Britons living in Europe. If the referendum goes in favour of leaving the EU, British citizens could lose their European status and possibly their right to live freely in Europe. It's also possible they'd be grandfathered into the EU system they already enjoy. But part of the frustration for the Ryans is that there's little information available about what their status would be post-Brexit.
Nothing has been made clear as to what position we then become in these societies that we've been living in, contributing our taxes to, our social charges.
What's aggravating for the Ryans and for Brits who, like them, left the UK more than 15 years ago is that they do not get to vote in this referendum. They can vote in France in municipal elections and in general European elections, just not in their homeland.
Now, OK, if it was a national election, I could understand why. We don't live in England anymore. We haven't for a long time. Why should we have any voice in what the government is or should be? However, this affects us directly and personally, every one of us. And nobody has given us a word in it.
The Ryans have children, grandchildren, friends, a house and a business right here, so France is really their home now. But they never felt it was necessary to become French until now.
We, so far, have not chosen to take French citizenship because we consider ourselves European. Why do you need a different nationality? You've got your nationality. It says on your passport it's European anyway, like on your driver's license. And should Britain decide to pull out of the EU, it would be a way of us nailing our colours to the mast. We will become French citizens as long as we're allowed to.
The Ryans say they hope that common sense will prevail and that British people will vote to stay in the European Union. But if they don't, they have good neighbours, those froggies, you know, to rely on.
I mean, a number of them have said, well, look, when they're coming to deport you, just come round our house, we'll hide you. And I'm serious, they do say things like that. You don't worry about it. You come round and out. We've got a spare room. You can stay there. And we just won't tell anybody, you know.
For the world, Adeline Cyr, Burgundy, France.
One of the big issues of the so-called Brexit is immigration. The world's Shirin Jafari knows what it's like to be an immigrant in Britain. She moved to London with her family when she was a teenager, and for a few years she attended a school for international students. Shirin got to return to London recently and decided to pay a visit to her old school.
It's been almost 17 years since I was a student at St. Mary's High School in northwest London. And back then, I was going through something familiar to so many immigrants. At home, I was a regular Iranian teenager, at school, an aspiring British one. I would go from chatting with my friends about the latest Backstreet Boys album to reciting Persian poetry with my dad at home. Now, I want to know what it's like for immigrant kids at St. Mary's in 2016.
Hi, everyone.
Come in.
There are six of them gathered around the table, four boys and two girls, all buzzing with excitement.
Yeah, close to the mic.
I came from North Afghanistan.
I'm from Iran.
I was born here. My mom and dad are from Pakistan.
I came from Kuwait.
The first thing they want to talk about is culture shock. Aryan from Afghanistan says his first question was, why on earth do the British drive on the other side of the road? I guess that's a question many of us ask. But then the conversation turns to navigating family.
So when we moved here, my mom would say one thing and then school would say another thing.
That's Maryam. Her family left Kuwait for the UK when she was 3 years old.
My mom, she's very paranoid about everyone here. She didn't really know anyone. She was used to the same faces every day. But here, her children, you know, we got used to having different coloured friends, different religions. And I think she was quite afraid that we might fall back from our culture.
So Maryam says her mom got stricter. No going out with friends and definitely no boyfriends. It was tough.
And now? I think now she's, because we've been here for so long, she's understood that, you know, things are changing. And the more time we spend with other people, you know, the more comfortable we get and the more used we get to their culture.
Another student, Ali, faced something similar with his mom.
Yeah, she was like wrapped me in cotton wool. She didn't want me to go out. She didn't want me to talk to other people.
Ali was born in London, but his parents immigrated from Pakistan. He says it took a while for his mom to realize her son needed to get out.
She told me that there's good people out there and she wanted me to go and experience life beyond the Pakistan community. And that was when I really first experienced London, and that was the first time I went out, went on the buses.
What was it like going out?
It was really different for me. I didn't know what Big Ben or London Eye was, and then I thought it was all made up places.
Across from Ali sits Aryan, the kid from Afghanistan. He came to London without his parents. The Taliban had killed his father. Next, they were going after him. Left with no choice, his mom put him on a truck and sent him away.
I came here by lorry, so I passed six countries. Actually, I came to Pakistan, and from Pakistan I came to Iran. From Iran I came to Turkey, from Turkey.
By yourself?
No, there was a smuggler who was taking us to these countries.
Now Aryan lives with a foster family whom he loves. But his terrifying ordeal with the Taliban hasn't stopped him from dreaming big. He wants to become a politician and go back to Afghanistan. And as a Muslim immigrant, he's been keeping an eye on what's happening in the U.S. He says some of what he hears makes him angry.
Trump, he said that he will not allow Muslims to come into America, or he will build a wall. He can do that, but he can't build a wall inside the people's heart, because that's not up to him.
Listening to Aryan, it strikes me that I left London before 9/11 even happened, before wars in Afghanistan, Iraq and Syria. So no doubt there'll be more kids like Aryan coming to Europe and the US for years to come. And like me, they'll be trying to make their new countries feel like home. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari, London.
We've got a weekly podcast here at The World you might have heard of. It's called The World in Words, and it's all about language. Today, The World in Words team is at the New York Public Library in Manhattan, and they're going to record a live podcast. It's about languages that are dying and efforts to preserve them. You can help out by answering a couple of questions. What's your linguistic heritage, and what languages did or does your family speak? Hit them up on Twitter, at Lingopod. They'll be posting a link to a live stream of the event there as well. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The Tarahumara are an indigenous group in northern Mexico. In the past, they had little contact with the modern world, but that has changed. One sign of that, an increasing number of Tarahumaras are working with traffickers to run drugs into the U.S., and that means more arrests at the U.S. border. Randall Gingrich directs Tierra Nativa, an advocacy group that works with the Tarahumara. He says the problem is primarily an economic one.
There's no jobs in the Sierra. They've been pushed out of the best lands for the most part. And it's a semi-arid environment anyway, and climate change has resulted in these devastating droughts that last months and sometimes years. So the Tarahumara have no choice to survive but either to migrate out of the region or to stay and grow drugs.
Today, how big has the problem gotten? Like, what percentage of the Tarahumara population in Mexico is directly involved in drugs due to narcos?
Well, I think overall maybe 15 or 20% of the Tarahumara, but in some communities it'll be 90%, and in other communities it'll be 2 or 3%. So it's really highly variable.
Randall, I know your organization, Tierra Nativa, doesn't deal directly with narco violations and human rights, but do you know anyone from the communities you work in that's been recruited by narcos?
A few years ago, when I first learned that Tarahumara were being imprisoned in the United States for carrying drugs, I drove up in the Sierra with a Tarahumara translator, and we ended up in the community of Noragachi that is not known for drug trafficking and drug growing at all. And the only person we found was an 82-year-old shaman who was just sitting on a pile of rocks, almost like he was waiting for us to come. And it turns out it was his great-nephew who was imprisoned in the United States. And a year earlier, he had been recruited with three others from the community to transport drugs across the border, and they had no idea what they were getting into. As soon as they got to the border area, the people they knew from the Sierra who had recruited them disappeared, and then they were in the hands of people who were extremely cruel. They were given like packs of 80 to 100 pounds of drugs to carry across the border. They were forced to march 20 to 40 miles across desert and terrain that they're not used to. And then there was the unknown of the border patrol, the Migra on the other side. And of those four Tarahumara kids that were, you know, in their early 20s, one of them ended up in prison in the United States. Two of them never returned to the community. Nobody knows what happened to them. And the one who returned was traumatized by the experience.
With many Tarahumaras only fluent in their three dialects, and there are few translators who know them, how have you seen that affect the cases?
Well, yes, many Tarahumara have very limited Spanish, so it's really hard for them to communicate their situation, who they are. Mm. And in the United States, there really aren't any qualified translators from, you know, Spanish to Tarahumara. So most recently, some prosecutors from Phoenix had contacted Chihuahua looking for Tarahumara translators, and they've just begun by telephone to use Tarahumara translators in Mexico to help communicate with the Tarahumara in prison there in some of the cases.
Does that mean that those 100 detainees are really very handicapped when it comes to defending themselves?
Very much so. I don't think that the prosecutors and, you know, agencies involved in the United States really understand where they're coming from. And I would imagine out of the 100 that have been processed in the United States, that only a handful have had access to a Tarahumara translator.
Randall Gingrich, director of Tierra Nativa, a Tarahumara advocacy organization. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Finally today, I hate to say this, but check your happiness at the door, because we're going to play some somber music. Dismal, downright gloomy. In fact, that is the name of the song, Gloomy Sunday. Just listen to Billie Holiday's version.
Sunday is gloomy. My hours are slumberless. Dear, it's the shadows I live with are numberless.
Gloomy Sunday is also called the Hungarian Suicide Song. It was written in 1933 by Hungarian pianist and composer Reza Sarez. But record producer Yusuf Sahili was not happy with just one version. He imagined a whole collection of different takes on the song. The result is Hungarian Noir, a tribute to the Gloomy Sunday.
It's one of the really saddest songs on the planet, and we asked our network to hand in different versions, and yeah, we thought we'd give it a shot and see how many versions we get and how sad they are.
So there are 11 different versions of the tune, each one really different. Let's quickly taste three different versions of the song.
Sunday is gloomy. My hours are slumberless. Dearest, the shadows I live with are numberless.
Santo e Angumelo, João anda de comigo. Levando o tempo, melonde o ranhaca. Estilo bastante, ele está com xinguei e puxi.
Cenário em frente à brinquedoteca. Impressionava frequentadores da biblioteca. Cabeça, pés, braços da boneca. Nada, nada na posição correta. O corpo aparentava pouco uso. Vítima, vítima do...
So we have Cuba's famous a cappella group Vocal Sampling. There was also a version of Gloomy Sunday with a flamenco tinge. And then there was the hip-hop version. What do you think, Yusuf, these different interpretations of the same song bring out in the tune?
Yeah, for instance, you talked about the rap version from Gok, Brazilian rapper. Mm. And you need to read the lyrics basically, but it's about the Brazilian favelas and how the suicide rate is really high there, and talking about people committing suicide in the favelas, basically.
I mean, this song kind of spawned what's become known as the Hungarian gloom genre in music. Hungary, as you may know, has one of the highest rates of suicide in the world. How do Hungarians feel about a song that encapsulates such sorrow and kind of paints the entire country as a sad country?
Yeah, this Hungarian suicide song was the first international pop hit that came out of Hungary, so everyone knows it, and they're actually pretty proud of it.
What do you think the role is of sad music? Is it supposed to make us happy, or is it supposed to make us sadder?
I think that considering the circumstances all over the world and all the sadness that is spreading through the news, I think it's just the most natural thing that we like to listen to sad music as well.
Sad lounge music. That was Yusuf Sahili of Piranha Records speaking with us from his office in Berlin. As Charlie Parker once said, if you don't live it, it won't come out of your horn. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Looking forward to a sunny Wednesday. We'll see you here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.